Hi, everybody. Y'all hear me?
Yeah.
We're good? Y'all nervous? Yep. My name's Brad. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic and drug addict. Hey, guys. Nice looking crowd. I met Martin in this very building in the summer of 2013. And honestly, I thought he was kind of annoying. He was the loud, boisterous, real funny, attention grabber, attention seeker guy. We weren't real close in treatment, but you know what? When we got out, we started hitting meetings a lot together. And ever since, he's been my best friend. I watched him grow. I watched him stumble. I watched him pick himself back up. And I'm real proud of him, the man he's become today. I'll tell you a real quick story about Martin. So we went to our first sober jazz fest in New Orleans. I think he had about 9 months and I had about six. And we pull into a parking lot and there's an open space next to us. And Martin's in the passenger seat and he's about to get out. And this cop car is coming in to take the open spot. And he kind of stops and hesitates. And he gets on the loudspeaker and he's like, "Come on out." So we got out, and he let Martin get out and then closed the door, and a cop pulled in the spot. And I couldn't help but resist and tell the cop, you know, we were so proud to be sober and to not to be scared in that situation. So I told him, I was like, "Hey, we're in recovery." He's like, "Oh, man, I bet I scared the hell out of y'all." He's like, "As soon as I said, 'Y'all come on out,' I knew I messed up." But anyway, it's been a great time spending my early sobriety and even now with Martin. And with no further ado, here's Martin.
Yeah, I didn't quite get right out of the car when the cop said it either. Let's just be clear. Old habits, but die hard. Thanks for the great introduction, Brad and Chris, for having me in Austin Recovery. It's good to be back. My name's Martin. I'm a grateful recovered drug addict and alcoholic. My sober date is actually 2015 of January the 10th. So there's a little math in there that was mentioned from the last two times that I was actually here at ARC. I don't know if they still have the setup the way they was, but there used to be a whiteboard in the common room. And you could write your email and your phone number up there, and you could like get a hold of some buddies and get a list going as you're leaving treatment, much like the small list that you got before you went to the jail cell to call people as well. But I remember that I'd gone in there December 17th of that year, and I'd gone out and come back so quickly that my name and my email address and phone number were still up on the whiteboard after the second time. I was pretty embarrassed about that. I thought I was setting a record. Of course, I felt I was always special, but that's not really the record you ever want to have. So Johnny Prince, who I'm pretty sure Johnny P is cooking you all that wonderful food in the kitchen, asked me to come out here and share my story. And, of course, with no hesitation, I said yes and then instantly regretted after I said it when I actually got the call back. But you know, my story is going to be similar to some of y'all's, and it's probably going to be a little bit different for some of you others. The most important thing is that you don't get hung up on the details of how it's different, but try to see the similarities. I constantly, at work, make this analogy. It doesn't matter if you got a Hummer or a Prius, as long as you get there at the same time, right? And it's about the destination. So my story of what it was like, you know, I wouldn't say that like I came from a family of means, but I didn't go without either. My mother, who had me at a very, very young age, at the age of 16, was probably still a child herself, you know, still a kid having a kid. And my father was just a few years older than him. My mother told me a cool story about my father, my biological father. He's like, "Yeah, I was dating a guy at the time, and then your father beat that guy up, and I thought he was so hot that I instantly dumped that guy and started dating him." And he was a rough guy, you know. He had some history. He was in the 70s, were they called gang members back then? I'm not exactly sure what the affiliation was called then, but he was into some stuff that was, less than legal. And I didn't really ever have a relationship with that man because at an early age, much younger than I could remember, he was very abusive to my mother. She ended up in the hospital, and she gave him the option. She said, well, you have two choices. You can either go to jail or you can divorce me. And he chose the latter. So I was kind of, you know, like a little, like a, the, so let's just say this. My mom was so young that she had two brothers and one sister. And so they were much younger than her as well. And then she was the oldest at 16, having me at 17. So I was kind of like the smallest kid brother. So my grandfather was my father, and my mother, who worked to the bone trying to keep, you know, to find us a suitable place to live and so forth. You know, I was kind of passed around with all these different kinds of nurtures from different angles. And so, my grandfather really was like my father to me. And I looked up to him very much. And I also had two uncles, and they were very contrast and difference. One of them was very violent, and when he drank, it got even worse and out of control. He had a very short fuse. You know, he had some mental issues that I believe. I'm not a doctor, but he had a very explosive behavior, an explosive temper, very, very short-tempered. And I had another uncle who was younger than him, and he was that kind of guy that, like, when he walked in the room, like, everything just lit up, right? Like, he could just make everybody laugh, and everybody wanted to be next to him, and everybody wanted to hang out with him, and he had a score of friends. And life wasn't really that hard for him. You know, he always seemed to have this knack of doing right in my grandmother's eyes, always, and always was kind of the center of attention. And that is what I gravitated immediately, right? I gravitated to that behavior. It's like, oh, well, if I make people laugh or if I can get them to like me, you know, I can feel okay inside. And I, at a very young age, remember that getting that gratification would instantly give me something. If I got your appraisal or your approval, or if I could do something that would make you laugh, and I was, you know, at even a young age, I was, you know, lip syncing to Cheech and Chong records of my mom's, and, like, you know, I'd put on these boots and a cowboy hat, and I was kind of like this pet, you know, almost like the little court jester of everything. And so at that early age, I recognized that I could get the attention that I sought without really having to do much except for just make people laugh. Now, what I was exposed to when I was younger as well was drinking very heavily in my family. My grandmother and grandfather were not so much drinkers. My uncles, though, drank very heavily, and they had two different types of drinking in my eyes. My uncle, Buddy, who was the asshole, you know, at the time, he would drink and get very violent. He would pull out guns, and he threatened my family, and I remember being at a very young age where my mom was in tears fearing for her life because my grandfather and my Uncle Buddy were wrestling in the hallway over a loaded shotgun. And those are the memories that I have of Buddy. And instantly it was just like, that's the alcoholic. I didn't necessarily know what alcoholic was. I wouldn't know what that was until I got here and got a good ass whipping after leaving here and coming back on my own volition. But that was the unsuccessful drinker. Then my uncle, who drank, got really funny, lit up the room. He was hilarious, right? And so that was the successful drinker, right? That's how I wanted to be, because everybody wanted to be him. Everybody wanted to be his friend. And so the funny thing is now in their lives, they both are funnier is that they're both cops, right? And one of them's probably not the one you get pulled over by and not going to give you much inch of a rule for letting you go. The other one's, like, you know, very still same way he is, very, very casual, very funny. But they both drank alcoholically. They both drank to an excess. But neither one of them, by my definition or what I've learned about my own disease, is that they were an alcoholic at all. They drank alcoholically, but they could take it and leave it as they pleased. Right, and for the right circumstances, they could stop, and they've done so, and they have both very successful lives. They have beautiful children. They have wives. I mean, they have very, very happy lives, and alcohol isn't an issue in their life at all. They didn't have to go to the ranch. They didn't have to go to detox. They didn't have to get pulled over 100 times. they didn't have to feel that desperation and that a lot of us have felt, to where they were sick of living the way they were. They were able to do so on their own. So I think it's important to recognize that for my own disease, because in my mind, my disease tells me the easy way out, right? Because I'm not the kind of guy that steps up to the line voluntarily, especially in the past, and am able to perform under pressure, right? You know, they talk about getting tight in the book, at the wrong times. I don't understand that term, getting tight. I thought it was getting loose by getting drunk, right? I'm not trying to get tighter. I'm trying to get looser. And so the fact is that, you know, knowing that in my circumstances as well, you know, I always chose the worst opportunities to escape. And it doesn't even necessarily have to look like drinking and drugging, right? It can be lying. It can be manipulation, you know, because I'm really good with this. I'm really good with the mouth work, but I'm really bad at the footwork portion of it, right? So I can step up to the line just enough to get the heat off of me, or to show up for my girlfriend, or to put on a face at work and seem like I'm a good employee. But at the same time, I'm kind of just like half-assing it the entire time, right? Because I don't really perform well under pressure, from what I thought. But what I realized is that I had issues with living life on life's terms, which is the biggest point. So I'm kind of getting a little out of control here, so I'm going to back it up in. So early on, I'm not going to go into a whole huge drunkologue of what it was like, because I'm pretty sure we all have a pretty paint picture of that. But the very first time that I put alcohol into my body, I was very young. I think I might have been in like eighth grade, and I had just moved from Austin to East Tennessee. And this town was called Morristown. Any Morristown people out there? I doubt it. So 10,000 people in the whole town, right? Whole town. And as you could tell, I'm a little bit darker than some of the people that are in East Tennessee. And I think I was probably the only Mexican that they knew, other than Frankie Poncherelli from Chips. Yeah, I'm that old. So I am 43 years old, so I was watching it when it wasn't a rerun. And so moving to this school, I was already very, very, you know, whatever. It wasn't the fuck it's yet. It was the whatever, you know, clean your room, whatever, you know, cut your hair, whatever. You know, I had a very rambunctious personality, and I didn't like being told what to do. And so when I get to Tennessee, I have these bangs that basically just hang down in my face. I don't know if anybody knows the bands The Misfits, but I was pretty much trying to impersonate one of the band members there with the big bangs and stuff. And my mom's like, you know, Martin, just try to make the best of this situation. Please, 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 just, you know, don't cause a lot of trouble. And, of course, my answer is whatever, right? So she's like, I would like you to shave your head, you know, and just get rid of the haircut, you know. And so it was a burr cut back in like 1989, and burr cuts were not like super cool. They might be coming back now. But I shaved my head, and she said, I bought you a nice shirt. I want you to wear this nice shirt for your first day of school. And I'm like, okay, I can go along with that. And then I open it up, and it's a pastel pink Ralph Lauren polo shirt, right? And this is when pink was not cool, like, right? It wasn't like it is now. And it wasn't even like the neon pink that kind of was big during those summer times when everybody would go on vacation and stuff. It wasn't cool at all. So I put this shirt on, and I suit up and try to show up. And the very first day of school, I'm sitting there. I hate life. I hate my parents. I hate this school. I hate this podunk town. I've never seen cows. I've never seen a field. I was angry, right? And I felt sorry for whoever came across my path. And there was a kid named Jamie Collins, and his middle name was Crusher. Jamie the Crusher Collins, and he was the bully of the school. And him and his two little cronies behind him were all like snickering and laughing and stuff. And I just knew it was about me. And so I turn around and look. And so one of the kids tapped me on the shoulder when I looked back and said, hey, man, are you a Puerto Rican? And I was all like, oh, my God, man. Like, what in the world is going on, you know? So the reason why I tell that story, other than the fact that it was much like jail that I got into a massive fight, and then they knew not to mess with the Puerto Rican anymore. But fast forwarding to that, I got the fight was broken up by a guy who was not only the wrestling coach at the time, but he was also the football coach. And he says, well, instead of giving you detention or punishment, you're going to go out for the football team. And, of course, I gave my usual, you know, whatever kind of answer to it. Right, right. So fast forwarding, I ended up making a bunch of good friends, and I got this big clique of friends, and everything's going great. Everything's fine. You know, no, there's no worries in the world to me at that point in time. I'd forgotten the fact that I'd been displaced with all my growing up friends from the neighborhood, making scores of new friends, pretty popular at the time. Even was able to hold a girl's hand. It was pretty advanced for me at that time. I wasn't really into girls as much. I was more into skateboards and stickers. But they were not like, you know, like skateboard stickers, let's be clear. And so so we're in our one of my friends after practice, they're not home. And they are, by definitions and my definitions, they were alcoholics. They would drink so much that they would put a rubber band around the bottle to let them know how much that they had drank that night. And if somebody had snuck into the liquor cabinet and snuck a little bit of liquor out of it, well, it's not really rocket science, people. I mean, you can just pull the rubber band down a little bit more. And between five bottles, who's really going to notice a quarter inch? It'll get four unpubescent boys drunk really quick. But we were all enamored with the lick it, slam it, suck it, which is the tequila, right? So it's lick it, slam it, suck it, right? And I don't know, somebody had seen a T-shirt, or we'd heard about it somewhere, somehow to do it. And we're doing it, and we're doing it, and we're like, man, we're doing this wrong. I don't know what's going on. It still tastes like shit. So maybe we'll slam it first, then lick it and suck it. And we just kept doing it back and forth, and we never got it right. It tasted horrible all the way till the very end. But what I do remember is the effect that it produced at that point. And at that point, I had this warming feeling coming over me, almost like this hug from a Snuggie or something from the inside out. It was like being in love. You know what it feels like when you're in love? You're like, your heart just like, right across your chest. And that alcohol just coursed through my body. And I knew at that very point, when I was laying on my bed listening to Two Live Crew with my headphones on, that I was going to be doing that a whole lot, and I was going to be doing that with whatever I did. And so do the math. I'm 43 now with 4 years in recovery and sobriety. I did that quite a lot, and I did that in every situation when things got tight or when it didn't get tight, right? So it would be whatever was going was good, it's time to celebrate. When things were going bad, well, it's time to drink heavily, right? Get fired, lose the girl, you know, whatever the case may be. Alcohol was that elixir, was that soothing agent that made me feel okay. Because remember, still, I'm the procrastinator, right? I'm the guy who folds under pressure. And what's the better excuse as opposed to admitting that to yourselves? You get the whatevers. But now, you know, advanced in life, I'm now at the fuck it's, right? I apologize for the language. I'm going to try to clean that up. But we all get there, right? The F it, whatever. You know, I'm going to drink, and I'm going to keep drinking. And what I found is that separated me from a lot of things. Right, it wasn't necessarily what would help me get things accomplished, because I did think that I was pretty slick and pretty smart when I would come up with these grand drunken dialogues of how I was going to change the world or how I was going to get this girl or get this job and stuff. It always ended up hindering me more than anything. So going through high school, college, pretty big drunkalogue there. No real consequences whatsoever, though, you know, on my view, right? Because Martin's grading his own paper, and Martin's making straight A's by my grade. By my parents' grade, I probably wasn't hitting the mark very, very well at all. And I end up going to college on scholarship and end up having a pretty bad knee injury that took me away from the sports. And I was then introduced to some pain pills. And what I found was that with these pain pills that I needed very badly, because I was in excruciating pain. I mean, this pain was just so bad, right? I definitely need to take it. But when you mix those with alcohol, the produced effect from that is remarkable, Now we're really running in the red zone right now. We're flying, and this feels great for quite a while. So, but at that point, and maybe this is kind of where you see a similarity, right? When you're young and you're drinking or drugging, there's a whole lot of fun, right? The fun's like up here, and the consequences are way down here, right? And then when you get older, the fun starts coming down, and the consequences start going like this. And at some point in time, it hits that 50-50. And, you know, I had a lot of fun for a long time. But when it hit that 50-50, the seesaw went like this real quick, right? The consequences went sky high. And I'm still a child. I'm still a kid, man. I don't have any responsibility. I don't have any kind of, you know, mentality to step up to the bar. I'm just like, F it. We can drink tonight. We'll worry about grades tomorrow. You know, F it. We'll just drink tonight, and we'll worry about that, the laundry tomorrow, cleaning, whatever it comes in. And that went on for quite some time. So fast forwarding again, I have no idea what time I'm on, but I leave college. I come back to Texas because I went to school for radio, television, film degree, right, in communications. And that's not exactly like the easiest or the hardest degree to have. Some of us would disagree. But I think that, you know, you take classes like the history of rock and roll and art appreciation. And, I mean, I can get into this, you know. I could definitely get into this. And at that time, Austin was booming with the film industry. It was like really big here. So I'm thinking with this half-ass effort through college and life that somehow I'm going to become the next Scorsese, that I'm just going to magically roll into, you know, some film career and just start making millions and having all this kind of fun. Well, the film industry's tough, and there's a lot of people out there that were a lot more talented than me at the time that put in a lot more work than I did. And I came out of school with a surmountable amount of debt to college, so I had to get a regular job, right? So then it goes again, well, F it. I'm not going to really try to follow my dreams. I got to follow a career. So I start doing normal jobs, working in IT, and I start becoming pretty successful, right? I start living a life that was kind of better than what I ever had. Of course, my bar was always super low, right? You know, because if I keep the bar really low, Martin's always winning, right? You know, if the bar's too high, I know what that answer is. I'll just say F it and drink anyway. That wasn't for me. No, I wasn't really into that at the time. Oh, it was just a phase, you know. I can pass off and dismiss those dreams pretty easily because, you know, I'm still an irresponsible person without really any accountability to me whatsoever. So here I am. I got a life. I got a wife, which turns out to be an ex-wife because I was a pretty bad boyfriend and an even worse husband at the time, too. And I had a choice. I had a choice where I could either move to New York and try to continue this relationship, or I could just stay here in Austin. And I decided to stay here in Austin. I wasn't ready to change my life for that reason. And at that time, I had lost a job, became unemployed. And, you know, there was some cocaine and there was some weed, a lot of weed. There was a lot of weed. Let's get it clear. There was a lot of weed. And there was some, you know, acid, all that stuff, you know, fun drugs at the time, bunch of whippets, all those kind of stuff like that, you know. But then I was introduced to methamphetamine. And they were like, man, you're spending all this money on all this cocaine. Why don't you just do a little bit of speed? And I was like, well, I don't know about speed. Isn't that stuff made in, like, bathtubs and, like, made with battery acid and people's teeth are falling out left and right? Like, I don't know if that's for me. And then I did speed for the first time, and I was all like, oh, yeah, I'm back on that bed listening to Two Live Crew thinking, like, yeah, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this a lot, right? And that behavior continued for, I don't know, a long time, too long, right? And then I ran into some more of those consequences again, right? Because I'm treating a condition that I have, right, this failure of defeat from all growing up into the problem where I think that drugs and alcohol are my solution, right? So I'm throwing drugs at my problems, but what really I start to realize is the problems lie within inside myself, right? So I was relying in my head and in my spiritual malady. And so the first time I came to ARC, it wasn't by choice. I came to ARC because I was looking at a considerable amount of time in jail. And so I know how to run my mouth and say the right things for you to feel like I'm the victim in this situation and poor me kind of situation. And my grandmother told me that, if you don't go to recovery or if you don't go to treatment and do this drug court program, you're probably going to go to jail for a long period of time. And so I said, well, I can dig that. You know, I can go to recovery. I can do that. And I remember getting just as high as I could. There wasn't enough dope in the house to get me as high as I needed to. And I even remember telling my friends, I was like, all right, guys, I'll see you in 28 days, man. You know, like a graduation or something. Like, I had no intention of staying sober whatsoever. And when I came here, I didn't stay sober because when I got out, I had all these tools, right? The things that they teach you. I have these things on the wall here, and I didn't really know a whole lot about it. It said God a whole lot. I wasn't into that. I mean, I was just, and when I got out, I just thought that I could just go to meetings and get a little bit of relief and pick up a chip every month and hang out with sober people and everything would just be hunky-dory, right? But what I found out is when I got out and I realized that the closer and closer I started getting towards leaving ARC, the more nervous I got, because now I'm expected to be sober for at least a year to the court, right, so I don't go to jail. And I have never done that ever in my life. I'm the guy who runs away from things. I'm the guy who drinks at problems. I'm the guy who manipulates and gets my way without having to do a whole lot except for just a lot of footwork, a mouth work, you know. And so when I get out, I think I cracked open my book one time, and I was sitting in a sober house, and I was just miserable. I was just miserable. I was going and getting an hour of relief from a meeting, which I had to walk up this big hill to get to because I didn't have a car, right? And that meeting is now my home group, which is the primary purpose group. I don't know if y'all been to PPG yet. They taken y'all over there yet? Scary as shit. No. It's about 200 people that they dissect the book and they go line by line and turn sentences into questions. And I was not hearing that at all. I was just there to drink coffee, look at some girls, and then go home and watch TV as much as possible. All right. So I guess the point of me telling you that is that, you know, I can get relief by separation, but the physical part of sobriety is the part where a lot of y'all are going through right now, right? You're getting that separation from the drugs. You're getting, you know, a little bit back to normal up here. But when you get out, you start having this emotional sobriety, right, or this spiritual sobriety as well, right, where you have to start dealing with life on life's terms. And I don't know how to deal with that. I know how to drink at those problems. I know how to avoid those problems. But I don't know how to deal with the problems that are in front of me. So needless to say, I didn't stay sober long while I was at that sober home because I wasn't doing anything. And I remember thinking to myself as I was sitting on a bus stop on South Lamar, and it was pouring down rain, and there was like that, when they talk about that fork in the road, right? You know, you have the easier, softer way, right? Or you could try this way of living. And I was trying this way of living, what I thought I was trying this way of living, but I chose the easier, softer way. I could either take the bus to my sober home, or I could take the bus to my dope dealer's house. And I knew that he would, you know, open the door to me with welcoming arms. And there it was. I started getting high very quickly. I think I had 2 months of sobriety when I left here. And I think I got a total of 3 weeks sobriety when I left. So, and that went on for as long as it did. And then, so I have this cycle with my using and my drinking, right? I drink because I can't stand life, right? Life's unfair, you know. Life's hard, and then I have to stop because my drinking is becoming objectionable, and it's destroying me. But it's the only solution I got, right? So then I drink all the way up until I can't drink anymore. And then I stop, right? So that's that vicious cycle they talk about in the books. I'm sure you all have heard this before, right? I drink till I drink and drink and drink and drink, and then I stop. And then I get started again, and it never stops for me. And I did that for quite some time. And I even got like a year of sobriety underneath my belt. And that's when I met Brad, right? Brad and I were not good friends inside this place as much. He kind of came in a little bit late. I thought he was kind of a know-it-all. He was like, he seemed like he was kind of like a big book thumper kind of guy. And I was just like, well, this guy knows too much. I'm kind of threatened by him. I don't want to be his friend. So, but when we get out, you know, we got this camaraderie and we end up becoming lifelong friends. I mean, I stood in that guy's wedding and I hang out with him and his wife now, they're now married, almost every other weekend or something. I mean, it's pretty incredible. But, you know, they always talk about like what happened, right? Like what happened? I don't know, man. I don't know. I just fucking woke up drunk, you know. The methamphetamine ninja came in and stabbed me in the neck. I don't know, man. You know, and it's very clear to me. I could say like I don't know, but I know exactly what happened. Right. The last time that before I got sober this last time, I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't praying. I wasn't being honest with anybody. I wasn't going into any meetings at all. I was basically just running dry and living on self-will. And me running on self-will will last a pretty good long time. I got to tell you, I'm a pretty resilient guy and I'm pretty creative. But at some point in time, once I put alcohol or I put drugs into my body, all bets are off, including for my friends, my family, my job. You know, there's countless lies and apologies that I might not ever be able to make amends for. I have a life amends to family members that I'll never be able to repay until I hopefully, with God's help, you know, die sober and make those amends along the way. But the time that happened, there's just no defense against the first drink is what they talk about, right? So I don't have any defense because I don't have any offense, right? I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not praying. I'm not meditating. I'm not going to meetings. I'm not carrying the message. I'm not being honest with anybody, and I'm slowly dying on the inside. But I've got Brad and my sober friends that I have to keep up this image with. So I'm showing up to meetings and getting an hour of sobriety, and then I've got 23 hours left inside my own head, right? And now that's turning into being at a convenience store and running into an old plug, and he's like, hey, man, what's your number, man? I haven't seen you in forever, man. What's your number? And that's all it took. I was like, give me your number. I'll give you a call sometime. And that number burned a hole into my phone for about two and a half weeks until I got a weekend, like Labor Day weekend or something, from this real shitty job I had. And I thought, you know, this is it. You know, here's my disease telling me, you know, now you got your own place, right? You're not living with a bunch of other dope fiends. You got a free weekend. You got a three-day weekend. You know, why not just have a little bit of alcohol and a little bit of methamphetamine? It sounds like a great time, you know? And to normal people, the people would be like, that sounds like a horrible idea. To drug addicts or to my people, you know, that sounds like a heck of a good idea, right? But I have no clear understanding of my first step. Because if I have a clear understanding of my first step is I'm fucked. I am absolutely screwed from the get-go, right? Because I am a hopeless alcoholic. I will do whatever it takes to get more drugs and more alcohol. And I am the burn it to the bridge, to the bitter end kind of guy. And that's the scariest part for me, because I have a lot of people in my life that I care about now, and I know that the responsibility that I carry for myself, I can't do that alone. And if I try to burden myself with that alone, I'm never going to make this thing. I have to be honest. I have to be transparent with people. I have to go to meetings. I have to show up here and carry a message. You know, I have to do work to keep me within a normal range of being sane and without being completely insane, right? So And I never, the God thing, right? I'm sure there's some people in here who might be struggling with it. I know I did when I got here and I saw, why is God in red? You know, like, it's not like that anymore. But there was, they had God in red. I was like, damn, man, that's intense, right? You know, like, I don't know if I'm already down for that. Because the only God that I knew was the kind that I kind of kneeled down to. And I did the Roman Catholic jazzercise where you kneel, pray, stand, sing. Kneel, sing, pray, stand, you know, all this stuff. And it's not even really singing, right? It's like some, like, words that are just kind of, Ale, balida, maia, you know, like. And I don't get down with that God. I never did. I was just like, I don't get this at all. Man, smiting me all the time. So hard. And but what I came to find was that even for an agnostic or maybe atheist or whatever I thought I was, just angry, I could experience a spiritual experience that was beyond my wildest dream. And not everybody that, you know, that has that burning bush experience. I definitely didn't have it early on in sobriety. But the last time, that weekend that I was talking about ended up lasting me for about 9 months. And there was almost a moment when I was going to tell my story at Northland. And they said, I was like, yeah, man, I'll tell my story at Northland. And I'm high as a kite. And I was like, oh, man, that's Northland. They're just a bunch of alcoholics. I'm a speed freak, man. They'll never know, you know. They'll never know. And so, like, 3 hours before I'm supposed to be here in front of all these alcoholics, I call and I'm all like, yeah, I'm really sick. And they're like, yeah, we know. We know. So thank God that's not part of my story. I'm glad that that's not. But that run lasted me quite a long time, and the consequences weren't there, right? So I was looking at felony prison, a lot of consequences stacking up, and the last time that I injected methamphetamine into my body, there were no consequences on the external side. They were all internal, right? I was lonely. I was desperate. There wasn't enough drugs that I could put into my body to make me feel okay. I felt defeated. I felt like a loser. I felt like just like I wanted to end it all, right? But didn't have the courage to kind of take that plunge. Or maybe I just had a different purpose, right? So not getting high. I got a ton of methamphetamine in my house, and it's just not working. It stopped working. It stopped working. And so I make a call to a guy who wasn't my sponsor. I was trying to get him to be my sponsor, but I was so high and twacked out that, you know, he was just like, okay, Martin, you know, just give me a call, you know, like, oh yeah, man, I'm going to give you a call. I just gotta clean up this sawdust off my kitchen floor and put up the rest of the, you know, these computer parts and I'm going to call you. And you're like, okay, buddy. Okay. Just give me a call. And, but I called him the next day and I was in tears and I was just like, I can't stop using drugs. I can't stop drinking. I can't stop. And he gave me some clear cut rules. He just basically told me, he was all like, I want you to throw away every dirty syringe, smash every pipe in your house, get rid of all the alcohol in your stuff. I want you to read pages 51 in the big book. And then I want you to get on your knees and ask for some help. But before you do any of that, I want you to get your funky butt in the shower because I'm sure you smell like shit. I was like, okay, well, I can do that. You know, I can do that. So I didn't do the shower, but, you know, I'm bawling and I'm like, please, God, please, please, please. Cause we all have those foxhole prayers, right? Like, I don't believe in God until I'm asking for his help, right? Until I need his help, right? You know, cause God's always been there with me, right? But he's not rowing the boat for me. Martin's got to do a little bit of legwork. So, I get down on my knees and I remember I'm just bawling and I'm bawling and I'm asking for help. I'm asking for help. Like out loud, just in this house of defilement. I mean, it was disgusting. Everybody's had that been in one of those houses. If you didn't live in it, you probably visited somebody and got out very quickly. But I'm on my knees and I'm crying and I'm asking for that help. And let's say, you know, like this is 9 months to 10 months in and the phone calls stopped from all my AA friends. They knew I was gone. They were just like, well, if we see you, we see him, you know, kind of mentality. But at the same time, I just got off the phone with Mike M, and I'm on my knees, and my phone rings, and I'm holding it while I've got tears down my face like a little baby, and on the contact it's got the circle and the triangle, right? It's like, whoa. And the fact is, the guy's last name is Priest. Whoa, right? You know, not as important, but he was all like, and he's such a little vato. He's all like, what are you doing, man? And I'm all like, man, I'm on my knees asking for help. I need help. And all it took was him to come pick me up and just let me talk a little bit. And he came back over, and he and I pulled out like 9 garbage bags full of defilement, you know, and everything, you know. And so now I'm desperate. I'm so desperate. I need help. I want help, right? I didn't have any of the consequences. But I knew that if I kept living the way I was living, there wasn't going to be any life to live, right? Because my biggest fear, right, and my biggest fear is to just keep on living this drug and fueled alcoholic life for the rest of my life and not die. That to me is hell, right? With a little bit of luck, I'll get stopped and I'll end up here, or I'll end up in TDC or Del Valley, right? And maybe I'll make a trustee, right? And I'll be okay, you know, because I don't have any violent crimes. But with no luck at all, right? And then with some more luck, you know, and for me with the bitter end, I'll just die and I don't have to deal with any of this anymore because I still don't know how to deal with life on life's terms, right? So now I've got a heart full of desperation and I need help. So I start doing what I was taught. Going to meetings, getting honest with people, start making amends quickly, get through the footwork as quickly as possible, and start carrying this message to other alcoholics. I don't know where I'm at on time. How much time do I have here? 5 more minutes. Okay, so here comes the good stuff, right? So no treatment center, you know, no police, none of that stuff's going on. But I have that awakening that for whatever it was that God made the drug stop working. And when I asked for help, there was a circle and a triangle in my right hand as I'm sitting there crying myself, asking for that help, right? And that was the miracle to happen for me at that moment, right? Whether the dope was bad or the drug stopped working, it didn't matter. It all happened at one point for me to have this moment to think that I actually had a shot or a chance at this, right? But I can't get away from the fact that I still got to do the work. So I got into the work. I got a good sponsor. He was actually my first sponsor, Tim P. He might come up here a little bit. My current sponsor now is Chad Payne. Chad P. He comes up here and carries the message as well. And now I'm currently going through the work again, right, to do a reevaluation of that inventory to see because there's things in my life that I find objectionable, right? Because I'm not just all aces, and I'm definitely not like a choir boy and an angel or anything like that. I still like to play poker late at night, you know. I still like to, you know, goof off and make people laugh at work because I'm still got that stage character, right? Because that stage character wants all y'all to like me, and I want everybody to laugh and all that stuff like that. But with 4 years sober today, 4 years, a lot has changed in my life. And it's not about the money that folds in my pocket. It's not about the car that I drive. It's about the peace and the restitution that I've gotten through working the steps, right? The fact that I can go to my grandmother's house and help her carry groceries in and not look for her medicine in the cabinet. The fact that my grandmother doesn't have to stand by the phone waiting for that call, whether I was dead or in jail, right? Now I get to call my grandmother and be of service to her, you know, and now, you know, what my life looks like now is, you know, I got a home group. I work the steps. I keep a very close contact with God because I know one thing is that he helped me, give me an opportunity to start my life over again, right? But God don't row the boat, you know? He might be the navigation or the co-pilot, but I got to do some work in order to have that spiritual experience and to keep that going. Because for you guys in here now, man, I mean, it's great. I'm happy that y'all all here and y'all aren't dead or out there on the streets and stuff. But I do want y'all to realize that sobriety has a shelf life, right? So the things that kept me sober a year ago, or that kept me sober 4 years ago, or maybe even the stuff that kept me sober yesterday, that doesn't keep me sober today. I have to keep seeking that experience, whether it's carrying the message, being honest and with my girlfriend, my friends, you know, showing up as the man that I know I can be, right? Not the man that I could have been, right? Because that guy's still out there too, if I start getting too far away from this thing. But my life is, you know, it's fucking great, man. It's great. And it's not about, it's the internal peace that I get from being able to do this program, and grateful to do this program. I don't, you know, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of times that a lot of us feel like this stuff can be hard, and maybe you don't want to do it or something, and that's fine, because there's going to be some days that you don't go and start off your morning with prayer and meditation. There's going to be some days that you don't do any 10-step work, and just know that those days are, you know, those will start counting up quicker than you realize, and before you know it, you're sitting there telling yourself, like, well, what happened? I don't know, you know? And so if you guys hear anything from the message, you know, hold on to all these moments that y'all guys got, you know? Don't get too held up on the past. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be tough going forward, you know? But you don't have to do it alone, and you're not doing it alone, you know? Whether you got God that shows up for you, because the way God showed up for me, it was with a guy like Brad. You know, God showed up for me in a person, and then it showed up in a meeting, in a group of men, and then I started getting more and more revealed to me. Before I know it, I'm blessed beyond belief. So I think that's it for me. I feel like I'm starting to ramble, so I appreciate you guys having me out here, and that's it. Thanks, guys.